My name is Dick Hilden. The title of this session is Living Humanly in a Technological Society. Just a bit about my background so that you know where I'm coming from on this issue. I'm an electrical engineer by profession. Have been involved over the years in doing high energy physics. I was in the Air Force for a while and worked on radar evaluation in the service. Following the work with in high energy physics, I went to work in the computer industry and have been in that now for close to 20 years. So my background is heavily oriented toward computer systems. I spent 10 years also in corporate management in a company, as president of a company in Minneapolis. So I've also had some time away from engineering, but nonetheless, most of my career has been associated with engineering, particularly electrical engineering types of problems. So that's where I'm coming from on this. This is the second in a sort of a mini-series this week on technology. The first one, which we had, I think, a couple days ago, we talked about our technological society and some of the characteristics of such a society. We talked about the fact that the message sort of this mini-series was that we are immersed in technology from the tops of our heads to the tips of our toes. And that's essentially every one of us in this society, not just the engineers and scientists among us, but every one of us. And that we are being swept along toward a world of ever greater efficiency, precision, control, orderliness, and that we need to consider from whence our hope comes in such a society. Now, I want to hasten to add at this point that I am not here to say that we shouldn't have technology. I think that should be obvious from the work I do and the profession that I am in. What I do suggest, however, is that we have, I think, or live in a situation in which there is a danger of technology becoming too pervasive, too much out of control, too much raised to too high a level in our value systems, and that the result might be that we will find some of the loss of some of the spiritual values that we hold as a result. If we place technology and progress at too high a level in our value system. That's what I mean to say. Not that I say we need to go all the way back to the point where we didn't have technology. That clearly is not the message I want to bring today. Today, I'd like to just offer some of my ideas about ways in which we might live humanly in a technological society. And they are just that, things that I would offer ideas that might be helpful for us. And then I would like to open this to a discussion whereby we can all maybe massage them a little bit, change them a little bit, add new ideas, whatever the case may be. We covered in the last session some of the rather exotic technologies that are taking place in our world, and we saw some of the very dramatic progress that has been made in certain of our technologies. And we talked about the fact that probably the technology that is going to most profoundly affect us, that is us in this day and age, is going to be the computer, in that it is making such incredibly fast advances now. It is moving into every nook and cranny, so to speak, of our lives, and will affect all of us in very significant ways. But I want to start this session now with an extract or a short section from the book Zorba the Greek. In this particular few paragraphs that I'm going to read, the narrator is speaking about Zorba. The narrator happens to be a companion of Zorba in the book. And it starts out this way. And the narrator is speaking here about Zorba. He stooped by a hedge and picked the first little wild narcissi. He looked at them for a long while as if he could not see enough of them. As if he were seeing narcissi for the first time in his life. He closed his eyes and smelled them, sighed, and then gave them to me. I want to describe for you the fact that Zorba is a big, tough man that you might not think would be this responsive. Then it goes on to say, and this is Zorba speaking, "If only we knew, boss, what the stones and rain and flowers say. Maybe they call. Maybe they call us and we don't hear them. When will people's ears open, boss? When shall we have our eyes open to see? When shall we be open, or when shall we open our arms to embrace everything? The stones, the rain, the flowers, and men and women." And the narrator goes on, "The universe for Zorba, as for the first men on earth, was a weighty, intense vision. The stars glided over him. The sea broke against his temples. He lived the earth, the water, the animals, and God, without the distorting intervention of reason." I think that's a remarkable account or a picture of a person in touch with things, perhaps with a life that is somewhat simple in terms of what we think. The statement, "without the distorting intervention of reason," implies the fact that technology has not pervaded too deeply into Zorba's life, at least to the extent that he is prepared to logically apply reasoning power to what he does. I think it's very interesting. I remember in another section of that book describing how Zorba came out on the beach one morning, and Zorba is, I can't remember his age, but I presume 60, 65, something like that. He's in his 60s. And he comes out on the beach and sees a bird, and it's a beautiful bird, and it's as if he had seen it for the first time. Well, in our society, it isn't very cool to stand in awe of something. I don't know if you've had that experience, but I have. I probably have flown maybe 500,000 miles on airplanes, a lot. Maybe you've had that too. I always have the urge when I get on the airplane to sit by the window because I want to see us lift off the ground. But it isn't real cool to say, "I want to sit by the window." You know, it isn't cool to do that. Or it isn't cool when you're walking down the middle of Manhattan to look up necessarily, particularly when you're on a business trip with a three-piece suit. It isn't cool to do that, and yet I have that urge to look up and just say, with great awe, that skyscraper is something else. So, one of the things I'm going to suggest this morning is that I think it would be good for us to nurture that sense of awe about things, both the things of nature and the things of that we have created through the techniques that have been given to us as a gift. So, the nurture of our sense of awe. Then that leads us to a second thought, and I think it's a very related one, and that is, I believe we need to look at the way that we think of things, our structures of thought. The word paradigm is frequently applied to that notion, that is, our structures of thought or the way we perceive things and look at things. I believe we need to examine in some ways in which we might shift our paradigms so that, in fact, do live more humanly. And again, I'd like to relate to you an experience that I had, and I think I've mentioned this to one or two of you before, but my life had been, as you can probably tell from the way I describe it, as a military officer, an engineer trained in very high logic. That electrical engineers, particularly those involved in the computer industry, are very, very logic-oriented. So I was very regimented, I was very trained in logic, I thought precisely, that's sort of my business. And I generally think that I have thought in terms of conquering this or conquering that. Whatever it was. I even applied that to my golf game or my tennis game or to many of the activities I did. My notion was of that. About maybe 7 or 8 years ago, I was in the Bighorn Mountains on a backpack trip. I remember the following day we were going to climb the Cloud Peak, which is the highest peak in that range. And I went out at 4:30 the morning before that day, And I don't know why I did that. I don't know if I've ever in my life been up at 4:30 in the morning before. But that day I got up at 4:30 and I went up onto just a short mountain above our camp, rather. It was probably 500 feet above it, significantly above. And I looked down on a lake called Lake Solitude, which was just between me and the sun. And I knew that as the sun came up, it would glisten on that lake and it would be a magnificent sight. So I sat there. And at that time, I was also thinking about the fact that in that place, in the Bighorn Mountains, the Plains Indians had considered that to be a very sacred place for them. And it occurred to me that a Native American had perhaps sat on the same mountain, perhaps had contemplated some of the things that were close to him or some of the things involved in nature at that point. I started out that morning thinking that the next day I was going to conquer Cloud Peak. That's the way I had always thought. You know, my structures of doing this or that had always been structured around conquering. At the end of 3 hours, it must have been about 7:30, the sun had come up, it had glistened on Lake Solitude, and I had gone through a long thought process. And I ended up thinking at the end, I'm not going to conquer Cloud Peak. I think I'll just be with it. I haven't said that very well, but I think you get the notion of what I'm saying. Not so much was it something to be conquered, but to be something to be with. And for me, that was a very significant paradigm shift. Not that my whole paradigm shifted with regard to conquering. It didn't happen in three hours, but that has been an incident in my life that has influenced it. And now over these years, I think my thought structures have changed in that direction significantly, from one of conquering to one of simply being with the creation, both the creation and things that are made by humankind through the techniques and technology we have. Maybe you've had experiences like that, and if you have, I would be most interested in your sharing them. We have looked at paradigm shifts, or at least we've experienced some of them in our society. We've asked questions, for example, about how we can continue to provide health care in view of the fact that the costs are rising so fast, so rapidly. And we have always, I think, associated or equated health care with more doctors, more hospitals, more technology, more nurses. And have now started to think rather in terms of those sorts of things, more in terms of what makes us become sick in the first place. And I think we are shifting somewhat from the emphasis on cure to more emphasis on care. And I think that's a marvelous paradigm shift for us to be going through, and I think we're going through it in our society. So I think our society experiences those kind of paradigm shifts as well. Theodore Roosevelt, I did it again. I said Theodore Roosevelt last time I did this. Nice, that was 3 days ago, and I said it again. That's because I talked about Theodore Roosevelt last night in the Central American session. Theodore Roszak has written a book in which he talks about what he thinks is a very significant paradigm shift taking place, even a societal transformation taking place. Or at least he's suggesting that it might be appropriate for us to move us away from the very heavy industrial orientation we have to one that is more spirit-oriented, that is better balanced between industrialization and spiritual matters. And I'd like to read it for you. He talks about the fact that this would involve in fact a revolutionary process. This is consistent also with Alvin Toffler's recent book, The Third Wave, where he projects even with a higher percentage of probability that we are going into a third wave of our lives. The first wave being the time in which humankind entered into agricultural activities. Now that's a significant thing. The second one was the Industrial Revolution itself, the second wave. The third wave now, he suggests, is one in which we are leaving the heavy industrialization era and going into a period that is very knowledge-oriented. And he claims that this perhaps is of significance equal to or greater than the previous two waves. So it is no small thing that we're experiencing. And I think that we're hearing more and more these days from just a number of writers that in fact we are at a turning point in history, that it's of major significance. Well, anyway, to get back to Theodore Roszak's statement, he talks about such a revolution and he says, "And suppose the reality we live by should experience such a revolution. What sort of political program would follow from that? Nothing less, I think, than that we should undertake to repeal urban industrialism as the world's dominant style of life. We should do this not in a spirit of grim sacrifice, but in the conviction that the reality we want most to reside in lies beyond the artificial environment. And so we should move freely and in delight toward the true post-industrialism, a world awakened from its sick infatuation with power, growth, efficiency, and progress as if from a nightmare. One reflects for a moment on how prodigious a task this is, on the burgeoning megapolises eating their way voraciously as cancer across the world's landscape." And I would interject here that, I don't know if you've heard the projections, but it is projected that Mexico City would have 35 million people in the year 2000 or something like that, just a staggering number. Now jumping back into the Roszak's quote here. "And on the proliferating mills and factories, dynamos and highways, mines and agro-industrial combines, on the accelerating techniques of communication and transport, on the torrential flow of research and development, on the tightening global networks of finance and trade, and on the disciplined, if disgruntled, millions of people moving obediently through the intricate patterns of production and consumption. One reflects on the scale and pace and monomania of all this which comprises urban industrial society, and how unthinkable it seems that this vast apparatus should ever give way to another cultural form, that we should even see it slow down in its expansion or diminish in its scope." He goes on to say, "Unthinkable, yes, almost as unthinkable as it would have been only four generations ago to imagine that we could have created the monster in the first place, but it was of our making and it is yet ours to unmake and replace." So you can see where he is at. He is one of those on kind of the cutting edge of this. And I mentioned before that Alvin Toffler has talked about paradigm shifts which he thinks are taking place, whereas Roszak's was a little bit more suggestive or speculative or perhaps wishful thinking on his part. Marilyn Ferguson, in a recent book, The Aquarian Conspiracy, makes a statement, this statement, and it kind of relates to the fact that there are shifts taking place. She said, "A leaderless but powerful network is bringing about change in the United States. Its members have broken with certain key elements of Western thought, and they may have even broken continuity with history." She calls it the Aquarian Conspiracy. "The Aquarian conspirators range across all levels of income and education, school teachers, business persons, and so on." She points out that there is sort of an integration of sorts between Western religious thought and some of the Eastern religious thought, which tends to be more mystical, and that in fact there are a significant number of people who are starting to experience paradigm shifts that are significant. And in fact she claims if there are enough of that, our society will reach a point where if there is some threshold number of people within our society that experience these paradigm shifts, that in fact there will be significant transformations in our society. Then another book that and I'm just going to do a few of these to give you a notion of what is being stated at considerable lengths these days, is a book written by John Nesbitt. John Nesbitt has written a book called Megatrends, in which he reports analysis that his organization has made, relying on just a very vast number of inputs from various publications throughout the world, which they claim will tell or reveal the trends that are taking place in our society. I'm not prepared to say how valid that technique is, but I think it does seem to make some common sense that, in fact, if you do collect just a host of information from what is being published throughout the earth, that you will probably see what trends are taking place. He says that there, and this talks now about a human response to the high technology that is taking place. Nesbitt points out that that whenever a new technology is introduced into society, that there must be a counterbalancing human response. Let me say that again. He says that what happens is that whenever new technology is introduced into a society, there must be a counterbalancing human response that is, he calls, high touch, or else the technology is rejected. And that the more high tech that is, and by high tech is very loosely defined, but I think you get a notion of it, that it's very advanced, very exotic, all those kind of words. He says the more there is of the high tech, the more that we as people, as human beings, demand that there be some touch associated with it. And I think that's an interesting observation that he makes. Again, I don't know how valid it is, but I think he offers some very quite valid arguments that it is taking place. He points out that the heavy mass marketing of high-tech products in the 1960s and 70s was accompanied by a rather strong movement toward the self-improvement or personal improvement movement that took place at the same time, and he associates these, one being a reaction to the other. In my business, which is primarily now oriented toward interactive systems, graphic systems with computers, we have noticed that the human being simply will not use it unless it has a very strong sensitivity to some of the senses of the human being use it. And unless those are included in the design of the system, that the human being will not use it. So we're seeing it also on a smaller basis. He claims also that another example of this, what he calls high-tech, high-touch phenomenon, is that as high-technology, life-sustaining equipment has moved into the hospital, and you perhaps, if you've seen it, you know how high-tech it is. There was a nurse here about last week, I think it was, who said that she now is... She's in intensive care units at the hospital, can't remember where, but somewhere, and that she is having to take a computer course in order to understand some of her equipment. In any event, Nesbitt says that as the high-tech life-sustaining equipment is moving into the hospitals, we have gotten more interested in the quality of dying itself, that is, we as a people, and have moved into the hospice movement, which is widespread in our society. And we see this effect in other places in medical care. There is more home care now and more home births. They're becoming ever more popular. He points out that he thinks there is an association between the high technology and this interest in more human aspects of our health care. To move just a little bit into some more what we would call theological or I guess that's a good term, viewpoints of this changing paradigm that seems to take place. I would like to read a short segment by Bruce Reitzman, who is in the Department of Religion at Luther College in Decorah, Iowa. He talks about a paradigm shift also that he sees, and let me read it for you. "This is the common need on which science and religion must converge. A new common paradigm of reality around which to forge new concepts of knowledge, truth, and value. This involves first the recognition that the universe or creation is one, a biotic, social, and spiritual community with finite resources in which all the parts and people are interdependent and important. The implication of this view are morally inescapable. Since no one is free until everyone is free, and no one is full until everyone is fed, We will have to begin to physically care for all of those things we share with other creatures, including the natural environment. For if that does not survive, neither will we. We also need to train ourselves and others to a new form of consciousness that runs counter to all our learned patterns of competitive behavior. To describe this, I shall adopt a concept from the natural sciences that was first advocated by Aldo Leopold. It is now coming into increasing prominence in the life sciences, that is, ecological consciousness. Ecological consciousness is not only consistent with the emerging scientific picture of nature, but, and not coincidentally, with the best of human religious vision growing out of divine revelation. So Bruce sees a very strong consistency between that paradigm shift which the natural sciences are identifying and the best vision that would grow out of divine revelation. That may be it, all right. Revelation. And I think that's an interesting observation that these might be, that those are so consistent. And revolution probably was a good word there. Might be a good word. Marilyn Ferguson, in the book I just mentioned, has said that humankind is in a kind of a unique position in that we actually are able to identify the fact that paradigm shifts are needed and that we can, in fact, bring them about, that they aren't something that happens necessarily just as a result of some coincidental occurrence of something, that we, in fact, can say to ourselves that we maybe need to change some of our paradigms. We have that ability. She points that out. And I think that's a point that is of considerable significance. I don't think we need to wait till technology has overextended itself so far, till maybe even the bombs start dropping. We don't need to wait that long. We can say we, in fact, should look at our paradigms and maybe make a shift. And I think I'd like to go back to a thing in Deuteronomy where God is speaking to the Israelites just as they are to enter the promised land, just as they're about to cross the Jordan. This is in Deuteronomy chapter 30, verse 11, where he talks about choose life. Don't choose the curse, choose the blessing. And I think in a sense, this is tied in with what we're talking. So let me read this for you, if I may. For this commandment, which I command you this day, is not too hard for you, neither is it far off. It is not in heaven that you should say, who will go up for us to heaven and bring it to us, that we may hear it and do it. Neither is it beyond the sea that you should say, who will go over the sea for us and bring it to us, that we may hear it and do it. But the word is very near you. It is in your mouth and in your heart, so that you can do it. See, I have set before you this day life and good, death and evil. If you obey the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you this day, by loving the Lord your God, by walking in his ways, and by keeping his commandments and statutes and his ordinances, then you shall live and multiply, and the Lord your God will bless you in the land which you are entering to take possession of. But if your heart turns away, and you will not hear, but are drawn away to worship other gods and serve them, I declare to you this day that you shall perish. You shall not live long in the land which you are going over the Jordan to enter and possess. I call heaven and earth to witness against you this day that I have set before you life and death. I have set before you blessing and curse. Therefore choose life, that you and your descendants may live, loving the Lord your God, obeying his voice, and cleaving to him. For that means life to you and length of days, that you may dwell in the land which the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob to give them. I don't know. I can't go into any biblical technique that will relate that or identify that as being related to what I'm talking about, but it seems to me that there is consistency there, that God has laid before us blessing and curse, life and death, and that admonition would be appropriate for us as a context to think about these things.
What was that scripture?
Deuteronomy 30, starting at verse 11.
Thank you.
So we're hearing a number of things from people, from people's writing about this. But the voices that we're hearing are saying that these transformations aren't going to come easy. And we know that's the case. And whether they're accurate in their predictions, in fact, that these coming societal transformations are going to take place or not is a question. And we need, I guess, to ask, what then is a Christian perspective? Should we be pessimistic about how drastic the transformations might be? It could be that, it just could be that we will experience a Holocaust. The judgment might be that severe. Maybe not. Maybe there will be in other forms. We don't know that. And the question is, should we as Christians be pessimistic, optimistic, or what? In order to get at that, I'd like to go to John Polton's book, The Feast of Life, which has sort of served as the theme for Holden this year. He speaks to that, and I'd like to read just a few paragraphs of his. It's called A Time to Begin Anew, and if you have the book, it's in the early chapter on page 5. In English, spring has two other meanings, at least. Both speak of life. The first is springtime, that season of the year when in temperate climates the cold deadness of winter gives place to the early flowers and buds and all the promise of returning life. It is linked with Easter and the message of resurrection. It is the yearly parable of rebirth as God's promise, renewal as God's way of life. So discerned, it is the reason why Christians have to reject any sort of fatalism, even in the midst of persecution or martyrdom, even in the gray half-light in which so much of life seems to exist today. It does not matter how the fatalism is expressed. It is not a proper Christian response. The 50s and 60s, by and large, were marked by optimistic fatalism. The world was regarded as basically secure and the future assured. Within that fundamentally reliable substructure, human choices were regarded as merely technical and strictly limited in their effects. The 70s and 80s, on the other hand, with their defeatist gloom, have cast a spell of generally pessimistic fatalism over the world. If the heresy of the earlier mood was, there is nothing we need to do, the heresy now is, there is nothing we can do. Applying both these forms of fatalism to life as a whole or the world as a whole leads either to a cosmic complacency or a cosmic despondency. A Christian point of view rejects both. Because God is in control, there is no room for despair or nervousness. Because He has called us to work with Him, there is no room for withdrawal or resignation. The biblical truth is that human responsibility and choice are awesomely real. We have been made only a little lower than the angels and given the power to make or break our world. When our eyes are open to see them, the evidences of renewal and of new birth are all around us. Our own choices can put us alongside the risen Lord of life, whose purposes everywhere are to make all things new. And I think that speaks to this. That is, with regard to where we as Christians should find ourselves. Okay, so I'm just going to summarize very quickly the four things that I offer. Maybe you have other things. Maybe you'd like to speak to them. First is that I think we should nurture our sense of awe for all things in the creation. Secondly, I think we should examine and change, where so moved, our structures of thought, our paradigms. Third, I think, and I didn't mention this before but implied it, John Nesbitt in his book points out that we need to, in fact, maybe I can find that exactly. His statement is this: we must learn to balance the material wonders of technology with the spiritual demands of our human nature. That's a secular book, and I think it's interesting that he identifies the need for the balance of these things. And I think that notion of balance is an important one. And then fourth, I think we should live in a state of confident trust and hope of a future under God's control, even though the judgment may be harsh that we live through. So I offer those four things and would simply ask if you have things you would like to offer, or comments or questions, whatever.
Well, in my opinion, there's one real key, and that is that now that knowledge and technology are bad, I believe that God has given us minds to develop and, you know, to keep increasing that knowledge. But I think as knowledge increases, so does responsibility. And when we ignore that, that's when we start to see that kind of fatalism or whatever. And I think as we become smarter and smarter and have more and more technology, that we have to also develop our responsibility.
I think technology is necessary. I mean, considering the number of people and everything, I mean, it just seems to be necessary, a result of the masses of people and everything. And but I'm thinking it boils down to attitude, too. Like, there are people that believe in that we're just a product of our environment, and we're a product of evolution, but we're just kind of controlled by the evolving, you know, we don't have a choice in our evolving, you know, that it's not controlled by God. So it's kind of like they think there's a philosophy that we're just machines, you know, that we're no better than machines. And so with technology, I think we have to have the attitude that we're not machines, you know. Because what machine is evil? What computer program is evil? You know, what number? I mean, there's nothing wrong with computers or machines. It's human, you know. The evil comes from within and our attitude, you know. So I think we just have to have the right attitude towards it.
Why is there such a strong tendency for us to think of ourselves in terms of machines, do you think?
Well, I don't know, like I was reading Francis Schaeffer, and he's a philosopher, and he has traced the history of philosophy, you know, and he was saying that it boils down to evolution. You know, people that believe that we just evolved and that there's no purpose or no God, and, you know, so we have no choice, you know, I don't know, like, I don't know how to explain it, but you know, he does, but it boils down to that, you know, and, you know, there's no spirit behind it, which is machines, actually.
Tying those two notions or thoughts together, in the last session, we talked about the fifth generation of computers that are being developed, and they're 1,000 times more powerful than those today, and they're going to be here in about 5 years. And the Japanese are stating that they're going to build them, and in fact, they'll be able to make judgments. And we see that in fact, that technology is in fact leading us on a path toward being almost able to think in the same way that a human being can. And maybe that implies a stronger responsibility. Maybe that's something tied in with what you were saying, that we need to be asking questions about this, I think, about the effects of technology or the balance between spirituality and technology. And if we don't, we're going to find ourselves so far down the path that our vision with regard to these things will be zero. Our thinking now is so systematized, in fact, that I think our vision is quite poor with regard to the meaning of these things. How?
Well, I was thinking what you said over there kind of fits in with something that I've noticed, that people, there's a lot of apathy. And you're saying that we're going to be making machines that can make judgments, and I almost feel like we're growing people that think they can't make judgments. And what she's saying is that maybe we have this concept of ourselves of such a direct cause and effect sort of thing, and that things just happen to us, we can't do much about it. And I don't know if that would be cause or effect as to why we admire technology. Technology is very clear what the cause and effect is. You do this to a machine and your result is going to be that. And I don't honestly know if that's because we feel that way about ourselves, or if because of our machines, we're starting to look at ourselves and say, oh, I guess the spirit isn't as important as we thought. I mean, for the last 40 years, that maybe the spirit isn't as important as we thought. Maybe it is just a big cosmic cause and effect thing. Because there's been so much apathy, it seems to me. And maybe that fits together a little bit.
Maybe it does.
Well,
sorry.
Oh. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
As far as I'm just wondering, as far as apathy, I mean, to me, the world is doomed, you know, because of the fall of man, and because of sin, it's doomed. I mean, we are going down, you know, despite the knowledge, despite the technology. Our knowledge, our technology has not saved the world, it hasn't, you know, saved one problem. It's just gotten worse, and we're just going worse, it's just getting worse, it's falling apart. But our hope is in God. You know, and in that verse you read, it says that thou may love the Lord thy God, and that thou may obey his voice, and that thou may cleave unto him, for he is thy life. God is our life. You know, and he is our hope. And, you know, so we're Christians shouldn't have that fatalistic attitude, because we do have hope. We have the glorious hope. You know, we're not hoping in machinery or in our human beings able to solve problems. You know, only God, because, I don't know, do you believe in Revelation?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, that you know, the world is doomed. And God is going to create a new heaven and a new earth. And, I don't know.
What do you think, then, that we should, as Christians, be doing?
Well, I just believe, I don't know, for my own life, I don't have power and a lot of authority or voice, but I have God, and I try to let him control my life and also change me. You know, I start with me, and then whatever he shows me to do, you know, wherever he leads me to, I want to be God's servant. You know, not the servant of man, but of God, and whatever he wants me to do, you know.
I think Martin Luther was asked that. Can maybe someone help me on this? I think he was asked, what would you do if you knew tomorrow was the last day, or today was? And do you remember his response? He said, I would plant a tree. Yeah, I've always liked it as perhaps the posture that we should take, in spite of the fact that it appears that the judgment on earth is going to be rather harsh, that we should live as if...
I think I plant a seed, you know, of hope in somebody's life. You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I wanted to ask you something about Marilyn Ferguson.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know she's a follower of Alice Bailey?
No, I don't. I know that I get a strong sense in reading her book that it's very, very Eastern, and I don't know that.
Do you know who Alice Bailey is?
No, I don't. Maybe you could tell me afterwards. I offered Marilyn Ferguson's only as a suggestion that we are seeing it within our society, and I would say that her book is fairly accurate. You had?
Yeah, I think when I look around, well, I work in a hospital environment, so I guess most of what I see as far as high technology would be in that environment, but I think it applies to everything. When I think of high technology, a lot of people are maybe frightened by two things. First of all, I think sometimes we feel powerless, even though we're not. You know, you think of a computer being able to make decisions, or, you know, actually it's been programmed by man, but you think it can make decisions for you or do things that you can't do or that I can't do. And secondly, I think it forces us to make some very important decisions that maybe we don't want to make. And when we didn't have so much technology, we didn't have to make decisions like that. And when you think about, like I said, the hospital environment, for instance, in intensive care, we can keep people alive now as long as we want to. We can keep their heart beating, and we can keep them breathing, and we can keep their kidneys functioning as long as we want to. And that sometimes forces us to make the decision, or the family, or the physician, or whoever it may be, to end that life. where before it was just natural causes that did that. We didn't have to decide it. It just, you know, life came and it ended. And now, because of our technology, that doesn't always happen. Sometimes we have to say, that's enough. And that's a very difficult decision. Mm-hmm. And another example might be in birth on the other end of the scale. Now with amniocentesis and ultrasound and so on, you can see life developing at a very, very early stage. And I heard a discussion, in fact, between a physician and another person saying, well, my wife didn't have such and such a test, but we could have had it. And it's early enough now where if you find, you know, deformities of one form or another, you can abort that life. And that's another, you know, very strong decision that without that technology, you know, no one ever would have thought of, or we didn't have to make a decision, or you didn't even have to think about a decision like that. And now we're forced to at least look at it.
Yeah.
And I think those, that's why a lot of people are afraid of technology, because it makes us think about some really important things, all the way to nuclear warfare.
Yeah, and then extending it to nuclear warfare, you can, the tendency now, or the movement is toward putting an enormous, enormous amount of control and power in the hands of very, very, very few people. And so those decisions are strongly focused in those people.
But I also think that's where humanism comes in, because you want to believe or hope that the people that have that power in their hands would at least think humanistically. You know, you want to believe that, or you want to hope that at least you would, if it were in your hands, that you would think, you know, think the way God would think, if that's even a little bit possible, or somewhat humanistically and compassionately.
What worries me about that is, if you look at the history of why wars were started, they were always started over some dumb little thing that in no way warranted the war to continue. And, well, that's another subject for 15 other. Holly, did you want
to? Yeah, I had a question. You said that somebody there, Theodore Roosevelt, said that there had to be a high touch to counterbalance high tech, or the technology would be rejected. I can't quite believe that. I think my tendency is to think that for every high tech thing, there has to be high touch for us to stay alive and whole and sane. But I'm not sure the timing is such that the high touch is going to follow the high tech closely enough to keep us alive and whole and sane. I think maybe it's true in a sense, but how, as rapidly as things are changing now, how long do we have to reject, to realize we need to reject something before it's too late?
Yeah, I think that's
kind of in that spot.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting observation, and I'm not prepared to defend his high-tech, high-touch thing. I guess there are things that would suggest that it is the case, but you're right. Quite often, we don't know until we only know retrospectively that we don't like a technology, and it might have been in place for 5 years and absolutely impossible to get rid of.
Mm-hmm.
If we wanted to get rid of it, just yeah, I think that's a good point. That I don't think we can place much confidence in the high tech, high touch thing.
But I think that people are starting to realize that decisions, not maybe not enough people, and maybe not people in the right places, but some people are realizing as soon as a new technology happens that decisions need to be made,
yeah.
Like the creating life thing. I mean, that's really, you know, as soon as that started happening, people started being concerned about it,
yeah.
Wondering morally and psychologically in all kinds of ways,
yeah.
Whether it would be a good thing or not. I'm not sure whether we'll be able to stop it in the face of the pragmatism of a technological society, but at least somebody's asking questions.
Yeah, and I think that is the important thing, and I think that's one reason that we can't be encouraged by seeing that sort of thing, that we do need to raise questions. Unfortunately, once a technology evolves, It is used. I don't think there have been, There maybe have been a few instances where technological ideas have been rejected. I can think of a couple that were rejected on a high level. The supersonic transport, for example, was rejected supposedly on the basis that it was ecologically damaging. But we don't know that for sure. It might even have been political or economic. Pierre, you were going to say something, did?
Kind of got lost in the process.
No. Sorry.
I was thinking, though, that what she mentioned about ignoring the spirit and how I mentioned about apathy, that it seems there is an aspect of human being that we're not considering. And in terms of how to approach considering that more, doesn't it stand to reason that if it's our rationality which is controlling us, we ought to begin to act irrationally? Just as if, I'm not quite sure how to put that.
Are you suggesting that we should start to act irrationally?
I have behaved very irrationally in my life. And I stand at this point and I look back and I say, I'm very grateful because it has given me the ability to stand outside and look at things in a very different way. I can think in terms of receiving something as opposed to getting the right answer to this question, to receiving an answer to it. And I think that's a consequence of my directly behaving irrationally as opposed to trying to do it right.
I would affirm that. I think that's tied in with the foolishness of God. I can't remember the passage that says, reasoning persons are going to think you're foolish for your behavior. And I think last night about the story of the Namibian story of them doing the badminton rackets in the airport. You know, just crazy things, irrational things.
Well, isn't grace, the concept of grace, the greatest irrationality that there is? I was thinking about that. Somebody asked at lunch whether there was anything outside of the church that could conceive of the term grace. And all of a sudden it hit me. That is one religious term that is only used within Christianity and maybe peripherally in some other religions. That there is no concept like that in the secular world at all. Mm-hmm. They might call it luck. That would probably be the closest thing. I mean, it would be luck. And luck you're supposed to feel kind of guilty about because you didn't earn it. Mm-hmm. And grace is such a positive term. You didn't earn it, and isn't that wonderful? So maybe that is the key.
Yeah, that is. That's an interesting observation.
Totally accepting gifts that you didn't earn and giving away things that you don't have.
There seems to be something too in the idea of giving without concern for receiving, mm-hmm. Just this whole kind of attitude of giving that not only reasons what's going on, but a whole lot more than that. And so it seems to respect the other aspect to being than reason.
Yeah. I would like to make clear that the name is Theodore Roszak. I goofed him up so much that I think that he needs to be pointed out. I also want to say that Where the Wasteland Ends, this book by Theodore Roszak, I think is a very, very good book. It's long, a little bit difficult to read, but I think it is a very interesting book too, and it describes very well this interrelationship of technology and some of the spiritual aspects of life. So I recommend that. I also recommend to you the tapes in the tape library by David Bella, who has talked on technology. There is one that is particularly interesting, and all of them are interesting, but one I would recommend particularly is the one on the question, what is time? It talks about how rigidly we have become locked into into a time frame, and that this is sort of a result of our rapid move toward more orderliness, precision, and the whole thing. And he talks about how much we are locked into it.
and how much we don't realize it. I realized after I heard that tape that we, in fact, have put ourselves in such a tight time frame that it just is astounding.
We're going to be hungry in 48 minutes.
Yeah. Well, we're at the end of the hour. I think we'll close at this point. I appreciate very much your being here for this session.
Thank you.
Thank you.